Ryan Wood is the leading authority on the top secret classified Majestic 12 intelligence documents and the 1941 Cape Girardeau, Missouri UFO crash. He's the author of Magic Eyes Only, Earth's Encounters with Extraterrestrial Technology, which is a landmark synthesis of over 100 UFO crash retrieval cases from around the world. He's a frequent lecturer on the UFO subject. He's taught college courses and made numerous presentations about UFO organizations to civic organizations and ufology conferences across the world. And he's hosted 7 UFO crash retrieval symposia from 2003 to 2009. He's the manager and creator of the Majestic Documents website, along with his father, Dr. Robert Wood, and he was the executive producer of the television documentary about the Majestic Documents that aired on the Sci-Fi Channel called The Secret.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, welcome, Ryan, to Exopolitics Today.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's great to be here, and I'm excited to share what I can about the enigma of ufology and ETs and the government cover-up and the whole pantheon of weirdness that is ufology.
Well, you know, you got quite a track record, and I don't know, because of your dad. I mean, you were introduced to this topic many, many years ago. So, you know, I mean, why don't you just kind of walk us through again how it all began for you?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Well, it was, I was maybe 15 years old, 1970 or so. And Stanton Friedman, a famous ufologist, now deceased, came to dinner, who was actually working for my father at McDonnell Douglas, and they were working on an anti-gravity program. And so I just sort of became interested, nothing really, mesmerizing or gripping at that point in my life. It was not until much later in my life that I became, fundamentally more interested in what was going on, maybe the early 90s. Although I went to a few MUFON conferences and was interested in what my father was doing, but the work that my dad, Dr. Bob Wood, was doing on anti-gravity was the basis of a senior project that I did in high school for the Orange County Science Fair, where I created a Michelson-Morley interferometer and tried to change the speed of light. So it was an intense introduction to physics, because I'm the son of a PhD in physics. So it was one of my first connections to really physics and UFOs and the challenge of trying to figure out technologically how do these things really work.
Well, I know that in the 1980s, I believe, when your dad retired from McDonnell Douglas and got interested in the UFO issue, that he got very attracted to the Majestic documents, and I believe you helped him with that. So, I mean, how important are the Majestic documents in terms of just understanding this UFO crash retrieval phenomenon?
Well, it's a great question, Michael. It's extremely important, because the first thing that people need to understand is that the Majestic documents are not just from a single source. They started in 1984, and then in 1989, and then 1994, and then in the early 2000s. We got like 5 or 6 different sources of material, from undeveloped Tri-X film to whole books, literally in manuscript form. For example, the Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers from Vernon Bowen. But these all paint a picture of deep military involvement and the highest possible classifications, top secret, Magic, Majestic 12, MJ-12. There's been a lot of sort of different specific classifications for them. And it's some 3,500 pages. Some are, you know, marked confidential and are related, and others are top secret code word or top secret, you know, Majestic MJ-12.
Well, I know that they are very important documents. I know when I got interested in the UFO topic and or exopolitics, the Majestic documents were really groundbreaking for me in terms of the detail in them. Now one, and of course they mention multiple UFO crashes. Now one of the crashes that they mention is the 1941 Cape Girardeau case. So, you know, what is it about that case that particularly interested you? Because I know you'd spent a lot of time researching that one.
Yeah, I think that because it was mentioned in the Cape Girardeau, because Cape Girardeau in 1941 was mentioned in one of the documents, and Stan Friedman originally started to do some research. I followed on that. And we found Reverend Huffman was mentioned in the documents. And so we found the granddaughter, Charlotte Mann of Reverend Huffman. And I went to Cape Girardeau several times and interviewed Charlotte Mann, and she did video testimony and provided commentary from her grandmother, Reverend Huffman's wife, sort of a deathbed confession of the fact that Reverend Huffman was called out and taken via police car about 15 minutes away from his house on Main Street in downtown Cape Girardeau to a location where there were three dead alien bodies. And the military later showed up. He provided blessings for these creatures and then proceeded. Everybody was sworn to secrecy and it all disappears. And Reverend Huffman basically doesn't tell many people, maybe one other person in the congregation, a guy by the name of Walter Fisk, but it tells his wife, and it lays dormant for a long time. But the some of the corroboration that's kind of interesting is that Cape Girardeau is the home of Rush Limbaugh, and Rush Limbaugh Senior and Junior, who had the radio show and has passed away. And one time a caller called in and asked about this case on the air on Rush Limbaugh's show. And he hemmed and hawed and basically said, you know, there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. So he didn't admit it on air, but I thought it was interesting and suggestive that he confirmed that. And we looked at, for example, the fire logs, the fire station logs of Cape Girardeau as a way to determine specifically when and who or, you know, what fire department went out to the crash site. And the biggest challenge with UFO crashes is determining precisely where and precisely when. And sometimes you have great data, sometimes you don't. And that was an example of one of our investigation techniques. We also went to the Baptist Church and interviewed the pastor there at the time. And look through some of the records there. And eventually I had a presentation at the MUFON Orange County symposium, and Charlotte Mann was there and gave her firsthand video testimony of the alien picture and her experience. And then I sort of backed off with Children and Life, and Paul Smith took up the mantle and has written a book on Cape Girardeau, the 41 crash. And he's done a lot more research after me. Well, one of the other things that we did in researching this crash was we went to the National Archives and pulled up historical aerial photography. So we knew it happened in 1941. You can look at the details of aerial photography in 1939 and 1943 or something like that and compare them and look at the differences between those two images to try to pinpoint precisely, you know, where this crashed and which field, if you could actually determine the disturbance, is we had knew roughly how long the trip was from the downtown house of Reverend Huffman out to the site. It was like 10 to 15 minute drive. So you end up comparing the historical roadmaps of the time and try to outline, well, here's the potential places where he could have gone. But it's a sort of a long-winded answer to how do you do crash retrieval investigations? Just thought I'd share that with everybody.
Well, you know, crash retrieval investigations are very challenging because, we're dealing with phenomena that happened decades ago, and often the people that are involved are very intimidated and don't want to talk too much without getting in trouble. But one of the incidents or the crash retrieval operations that historically was very significant for my research, and I know for your dad as well, was the Los Angeles air raid incident in 1942, February, where apparently two craft crashed, and they're mentioned in these Majestic documents. So do you want to tell us about that incident and what the Majestic documents say?
Yeah, I mean, this was the Los Angeles air raid time, and we were at, I guess, war with Japan, and there was all these anti-aircraft shells fired off. But eventually, according to some of the documents, there was two crashes, one that crashed into the ocean and was recovered by the Navy, and the other was into the San Bernardino Mountains that was recovered by the Army. One of the memos to, I think, Eisenhower, stated these were both of non-conventional, non-earthly aerodynamics or capabilities, and this was the impetus to formulate the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit and begin to, in an organized way, collect and gather and provide a mechanism for the Army and the Air Force to understand and collect all sorts of data about these sorts of events. And this was the original precursor to Project Blue Book and others. And this is not just a figment of my imagination. The Freedom of Information Office has acknowledged in FOIA requests that there was an Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, but the records have been destroyed or missing or non-consequential. But it's clearly acknowledged that there was such a unit, and that it's real. So I find that interesting and supportive. But these were some of the first UFO crashes besides Cape Girardeau that really caught the attention of our government and military. I believe that Roosevelt told Vannevar Bush, you know, this is all great that you guys have found these celestial gifts and so forth, but, you know, just ignore it, shelve it, go win the war, and then we'll go get you all fired up about reverse engineering and creating, you know, Majestic 12, or, you know, formed in September of 47, along with the CIA and other organizations around and the Atomic Energy Act to investigate crashes and begin the effort at reverse engineering alien craft.
Yeah, the Los Angeles air raid incident is also fascinating because there's an important kind of connection here with the Douglas Aircraft Company, where your dad began working in the 1950s. And according to William Tompkins, the crash and the recovery of those two vehicles led to Douglas Aircraft Company forming a think tank called Advanced Design, and something similar happened with Lockheed's, you know, with the creation of Skunk Works. And then eventually, as you said, that, you know, they have these craft, these UFOs that are kind of like celestial or extraterrestrial in origin, but the president says that, no, we're not going to study these to reverse engineer them because they're too difficult. Well, he was advised that. And of course, later, you know, after the war, then things will take off. But yeah, anything you want to say about that sequence of events? Because it struck me as very interesting given what William Tompkins later said and your dad's involvement with the Tompkins case.
Yeah, I honestly have not followed the Tompkins story very deeply. My father was doing that. I guess what I could say is that I believe that, you know, I guess Douglas got one half and Lockheed got the other half. And it's pretty clear that Lockheed may have had more success at reverse engineering, at least according to, you know, Ben Rich and his going away party at from the Skunk Works, where he admitted to Jan Harzan and I think some others that they have the technology to take ET home, and that I think that, you know, they found the mistakes in the equations and they figured out gravity control, and I honestly believe that there is a proprietary knowledge set inside Lockheed and maybe other corporations, the Aerospace Corporation, for example, or EG&G, that understands the principles of anti-gravity and has taken advantage of it in an unsupervised, uncongressional, maybe outside the military way, or in a very limited liaison way to the military. I'm reminded of a key thought that I've been having all the time, is that there's really three types of knowledge. There is the white world knowledge, which is the scientific community around the world that does all sorts of experiments and learns, and everybody's peer-reviewed, open literature, etc. And there's naturally the black world, where you have all sorts of classified research and development, classified patents, and so forth. And then there's the proprietary world, the trade secrets, the tradecraft, the secrets of anti-gravity, for example, or maybe the secrets of fusion, or technologies that would be significantly disruptive to humanity and maybe that's why they keep it secret rather than divulging it. But they're all economic entities, you know, they have stocks and prices, and they want to maintain their economic edge, so to speak. But I guess that's what I could say. I don't really know that much about Bill Tompkins other than, you know, I've got a big stack of reading to do.
Right. Well, I know that that 1942 crash was very significant for a number of reasons, you know, that we've already discussed. But one that kind of like I thought was kind of very interesting is that, as far as I know, it's the first one where you can actually find some official correspondence between President Roosevelt and General Marshall, who was the Secretary of War at the time. And, you know, so these are leaked documents, but what was I found very interesting was that also there's a FOIA document there's a FOIA document that's part of that chain of correspondence, and the FOIA document pretty much leaves it all hanging, but the Majestic documents, they give you the beginning, you know, the alpha and the omega of this correspondence. So you want to, because I think it's very important, because people are going to start looking at the history of crash retrievals, and here in the 42 incident, you have the first official correspondence between a president and his secretary.
General Marshall, yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Michael, because it is, in fact, in the appendix of Magic Eyes Only in the back, along with the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report and several other interesting documents, Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities, Technology Recovery and Disposal. But, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Marshall, and I'll tell you a story. I went to Virginia Military Institute. I don't know if you've ever been there before, where General Marshall's archives are, including his desk calendars. And right there, you can go to July of 1947, and you discover that all of July is missing. It's just gone. Everything else is there. But, you know, the handwritten notes of, well, I have a meeting here, or this is what I'm going to meet with, you know, it's a desk calendar, and it's real diary of activity. But when it comes to July of 47 and the Roswell time, it's gone. And there's all sorts of missing documents everywhere. Now, also at the Virginia Military Institute, there's a cryptographic library, and the archivist or librarian for that shared a story with us that I don't know quite what the date was, but one day the National Security Agency showed up. And, you know, flashed their badges and said, you know, hey, we're closing the door and we're going through this whole library. And I think like 2 days later, they left with three suitcases full of books and documents. That's just an example of, you know, if they think there's something that could get out in the public domain that they're worried about, they'll just come and take it. And there's potentially a whole book about missing documents, missing evidence that should be there but is gone. Where it goes, whether or not it's destroyed or archived someplace else, don't know. But I thought I'd share that story. I don't know if you ever heard that before. Mm-hmm.
I know that you know, there's a sequence of events. I mean, you have the Cape Girardeau, you have the Los Angeles Air Raid case, you have this decision by President Roosevelt that all the recovered flying saucer craft, that they weren't going to put a lot of energy into understanding these until after the war. And then after the war, the Roswell crash happens in July of 47, and then things just seem to take off. And one of the key pieces of kind of evidence, or one of the documents that tells us a lot about what happened at Roswell, is this interplanetary phenomenon assessment. So, you know, you already mentioned the interplanetary phenomenon unit. So you want to tell us about this assessment that they came up with?
Yeah. Well, it's a report about the crash. I think it starts off at 2332 Mountain Standard Time, two craft drop off radar, and then crash into the desert. So it's interesting in that there's several things that that sort of catch my eye. I mean, there's first things you want to try to think about is, well, how do I know this is real? What sort of authenticity metrics can you figure out? And you start looking at these stamps that are difficult to see. As in the lower left, it says JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, file copy. And then there's another one a little bit to the right that's harder to read. It says CCS, I think Combined Chiefs of Staff. And, you know, people have heard of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm not sure they've heard of the Combined Chiefs of Staff. And so when you look at that, oh, yeah, there really is one. Or the timestamp in the upper right-hand corner is a 12-hour timestamp instead of the typical 24-hour timestamp. So that seems weird. Does that really happen in that time frame? And yeah, oh, sure enough, it does. And then there's other oddities like this on the first page there. There's this hard-to-read block, although it's reprinted in my book, so you can read it, that says that it not only takes an executive order from the president, but approval from Majestic Security and Intelligence Command. And so here you get a first glimpse of the fact that it's not just the president that's involved. It seems to be some sort of other control body that is legally has rights. The president can't just say, I declassify it. Is it, it implies there's some sort of classified law when it comes to this topic. And then there's other comments in the content, for example. They talk about Dietlif Bronk and Charles Ethan Ray did an autopsy of an alien in the back, and I said, well, who's Charles Ethan Ray? This is Charles E. Ray. So he was a buddy with Leslie Groves in the Manhattan Project. He was a surgeon in Minnesota, and I found his daughter, who lived up in Seattle on Mercer Island, and interviewed her and asked her, do you think your father could have autopsied an alien? And she said, absolutely. And I mean, not technically, but it was within her mindset that it was very a believable story, although she didn't say, oh yeah, I heard that story. But I just thought it was interesting. And then that leads you into, you know, where Ray did his medical residency at the University of Minnesota, and some of the other Majestic documents that talk about biological weapons and retroviruses, you know, before Watson and Crick discovered DNA and the nature of the cutting edge of bacteriology and virology was at the University of Minnesota, and the nature of how that science was progressing, and you know, is the term retrovirus an appropriate term for that era and time? And it turns out it was. And so and then there was all sorts of other weird things. I think Ray also was an expert in animal diseases earlier in his life. And you know, weird pathogens of rodents and animals, and so that was a skill set that might prepare him to look at alien bodies and that weird biology.
One of the cases that you include in Magic Eyes Only is this 1933 flying saucer crash at Magenta, Italy. Now, that one has been kind of like circulating for a few years now, but all of a sudden it's been kind of thrown up there front and center because David Grush talked about it as one of the cases that he felt was authentic. So you want to tell us about this case and you know, when you got interested in it?
Well, it was sort of filling in the blanks. I sort of put it in the book, Magic Eyes Only, for completion, because there was, again, Grush's testimony. He said the 30s sometime. I'm surprised that if he really was read in and briefed on the history of this, it would have been earlier than that. He might have gone back to the 1897 case in Texas, or Cape Girardeau, or the LA cases. But I think, you know, the 33 case, I mean, my understanding is that was a Mussolini gave it to Hitler. And there you have the beginnings of potential discussion, rumors, reverse engineering of Nazi Germany examining crashed saucers and having the best scientists, in my mind, in the world, and specifically at that time, look at that technology. And I think there is a lot of knowledge that is still to come out of, you know, the interviews with Nazi scientists still haven't been declassified. The guys at Pinatubo and all sorts of work. Todd Ryder, who's a researcher in German and Nazi science in Massachusetts, has a great website that he has a 5,000 page book about the technology associated with German scientists. It's very stunning and interesting. You know, it's not widely believed or understood, but I've looked at, you know, primary documents that says, hey, they figured out superconductivity and the nature of this dual pair of electrons or atoms, this duality that causes superconductivity, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, long before it's widely accepted in the 70s, according to Wikipedia, that we've done superconductivity. So his work really highlighted for me how much data is being withheld about real German and Nazi science that was captured during the war. And no doubt, I suspect, a lot of it related to this 33 crash, or if it in fact is true, is still there to be uncovered in the archives of the CIA.
Well, we know that the 1933 case, I mean, those were documents that were released that were official fascist Italy documents. And so, you know, you have David Grush saying that this is now something that is discussed within the classified world, putting that case front and center as an authentic, genuine case. And we know that fascist Italy and Nazi Germany collaborated on flying saucer technology. That was known after the war. I think it was 1950, this Italian aeronautical engineer Giuseppe Baluzzo talked about the German-Italian flying saucer program, and there were others that talked about that as well. And apparently they had some success in reverse engineering these flying saucers that had been captured or had come into the possession of the Nazis and the fascists. So if the Nazis and the fascists had success in like 10 years or whatever in reverse engineering these flying saucers, so what do you make of these claims from people like David Grush, Bob Lazar, and some of the others, Jeremy Corbell, saying that yes, or Dr. Eric Davis saying yes, these are craft, they've been recovered. Corporations have had no success in reverse engineering that. What do you make of those kind of claims?
Well, it seems a little unbelievable that they, quote, have had no success. I just don't think that's true. The challenge is how do you prove it? I think Grush's testimony was outstanding. I mean, I suspect his knowledge base was sort of, you know, modern understandings in the last, you know, 20 years. He'd only been in the military for 20 years, but he may have read all sorts of things. And what I found was really powerful about his testimony is, oh yeah, I'll give you in a top secret SCIF names of people, cooperative and uncooperative, names of corporations. In my mind, it's Boeing, it's Lockheed, it's Aerospace Corporation, it's EG&G, it's, you know, it's those ones that I can think of right away. Bechtel, the Rand Corporation, possibly, maybe more in their archives. But until you sort of have the power of an FBI team and the presidents of those corporations to literally go anywhere and interview anybody and waive their non-disclosure and legal risks, you can't really get to the bottom of it. But I found it very interesting and compelling, and I think the door is open, and that there are now 100 more people that have heard super interesting classified testimony about the nature of our reverse engineering technology and so forth. And the challenge is anti-gravity is free energy. It's a total rewire of the world, just the way fusion is. And as the CEO of Electric Fusion, I'm working on fusion as well in a way that's super low cost. So that's I think the testimony was incredibly important, and the work of Tim Bruchette and Mace and Raskin and Ogles and all the other congressmen that were there, you know, asking good questions is also important. They should do another event, and you know, have me Abdolin, and a few other people that have been around the field for a long time that can point to specifics of what's really going on.
Well, before the Roswell UFO crash became very, very popular, the most well-known UFO crash retrieval operation was the 1948 Aztec Flying Saucer crash. And that was because in 1950, a very popular reporter, Frank Scully, wrote a book called Behind the Flying Saucers. So just how important is the Aztec UFO crash?
Well, I think it is important. I think in my book, I end up rating all the various crash retrieval events in a scale from low to medium, low to medium, medium, high, high. And I think this was a medium high case. And this authenticity process involves many different aspects, from the provenance of the information, the witnesses, the credibility of the witnesses, any material evidence, physical evidence, and what's called zingers in documents, weird facts. But I think it is a very important case, and I believe that there's another set of documents that were leaked that support the authenticity of that event, and that's all helpful. I mean, it's really, my goal with Magic Eyes Only was to just say there's 104 cases that seem, you know, reasonably credible. Some are more credible than others, and that it only takes one or more to drag more of the world kicking and screaming to the reality of the ET presence. And I mean, for me, my focus has been on crashed hardware and government documents, where many other people in ufology focus on experiencers or interfacers, abductions, or other aspects of ufology that are just as important. My focus has been on that. And actually, what really got me fired up to go back into this was when I started using artificial intelligence and ChatGPT, ChatGPT-4 for my company, and began to train it on specific scientific data around fusion, but also train it around UFOs, and that caused me to start writing questions, which eventually became a book called The AI Ufologist, which is now out on Amazon. I wrote the first question in, and I got back an answer, and it stunned me. I mean, I knew most of the answers. You know, what was the ET agenda was the question. I got back 14 items. And I said, well, I know like 8 or 9 of them, but I forgot all these other ones. And so that sparked my curiosity to ask a more sophisticated question and keep going to talk about the other questions of, why do they abduct humans, and what's the national security threat, and how can the ETs and humanity get along? And it became sort of over the next 16 hours that I spent mesmerized and engulfed, just hammering away and learning. I found it a great experience. And it's very much a different book. It's not about crashes and retrievals. It's more about a blueprint for how to manage and understand the ET presence and humanity. So I don't know what you thought of it, Michael. I mean, you've been around the block a long time with a lot of different things. What was your reaction when you saw it come across your desk?
Well, I thought it was interesting that, I mean, because AI, as you well know, is only as good as the data that is fed into it. And you have been, I think, for certain decades now, compiling enormous databases on the UFO phenomenon and witness testimonies and leaked documents and FOIA documents, and you created UFO decks. And that was, and I remember we talked about that, or you contacted me about that, you know, 15 years ago or something like that. Yeah. And so, you know, that vast pool of information that at the time that you had, you found a way of being able to bring that out using modern day AI, which I thought was intriguing. And of course you posed 30 questions, and that the answers that AI ufologist gives, it's not just, say, someone using AI and feeding it kind of like a sophisticated program to answer these questions. What you've done, you've programmed the AI with all this vast database, so the questions, the answers that are given are going to be based on that vast pool of information, which I think is very original.
Well, yeah, it is, and I mean, UFODEX is still a work in progress. I mean, it's a website that people can't log into yet or use yet, but it's becoming. It will have a front door, and it will allow people to access it. But I'm just sort of building up the repository. There's a lot of complexity in the logistics of doing that, and having people's hard work not be stolen or misrepresented, and ensuring that people can't just copy books willy-nilly and that they get a snippet that's representative. And the AI tools keep getting better and better. I mean, right now, the conversational aspects of it are very good. But you really want images, and you want video, and you want so much more, and that will come in time. I found it to be a very interesting exercise, and it's a, you know, why do they keep it secret? What is the function of the MJ-12? How will ufology and private space companies get along? In, you know, what is the economic turmoil associated with an ET disclosure? Or other questions were, you know, what's the technological message in crop circles? It goes on to ask more and more questions. These are the questions that I was fascinated with to try to sort out in my mind. And learn more, and I found that I learned maybe 30% that I didn't know, and of course it's often written very well and very readable, and more succinctly than other styles that could be more verbose and long-winded. And so it's pretty crisp. It's somewhere between a PowerPoint presentation and a short novel. So it's I found it very a fun exercise and process. And I keep thinking of new questions too. Like I fed it the Einstein-Oppenheimer leaked Majestic document and asked it to summarize the key questions that that were being posed to Einstein and Oppenheimer in 1947 about the ET phenomenon. And a lot of it revolved around the legal frameworks of ETs wanting to settle here, or because we don't have a unified planetary global government, you know, how can they negotiate with anybody, or how can there be a framework of understanding between the ETs and planet Earth? I think they just sort of ignored it and done what they wanted to do and minimized contact. But anyway, I don't want to just keep rambling on.
Well, the UFO crash retrieval genre has come of age, and we know that the U.S. Congress is looking into it. They just had a classified briefing where the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community shared information, essentially corroborating that David Grush was correct. And you know, Grush has talked about 40 whistleblowers, insiders with detailed knowledge of, I think it was up to 30 UFO crashes. And the thing is, your book at the moment, I mean, the second edition of Magic Eyes Only, as far as I know, that's the kind of authoritative manual for UFO crashes at the moment. I mean, you had something by Leonard Stringfield in the 1990s, but I mean that was the first attempt, and there was a lot of data in there. But you've kind of like taken all of that information and organized it and combined it with the Majestic documents to come up with something that I think, you know, should be given to people like Tim Burchett and the House Oversight Committee. They should have a copy of this, and they should be asking the Inspector General and witnesses associated with Grush, well, you know, what happened with the Cape Girardeau crash? Well, what happened with that crash? So, yeah, you want to kind of take us?
Yeah. You make a great point, Michael, and I have. I've sent like 8 or 9 copies to various members of the House committee there, and offered to point them in the right direction as far as where all sorts of documents are. Besides what's in this leaked area, I mean, it's funny, I started to answer some of the questions posed by Tim Burchett. And I think one of them was, well, you know, where specifically should I look for more information about this? And I said, you know, to me, my response was Record Group 341, Entry 47, Folder 12. There's a whole file on, you know, it's not a smoking gun, but a smoldering gun of specifics of that are right in Vault 631 at the National Archives. Now, Vault 631 is massive. I mean, it's the size of a football field. Nevertheless, there's a lot of specific areas that I can point to. For example, in the 2003 UFO crash conference, I gave a lecture called Evidence from the Archives. And I had been to the National Archives and rummaged around and looked at a whole variety of documents that I found. There's one document from the 1950s from Robley Evans that talks about a crashed saucer in Mexico. I think they're referring to the El Indio Guerrero crash. And that the details are so bizarre that I don't know what to make of it. Mentions, you know, crashed aliens. And so it's, there are snippets like that that are right there, along with a massive number of withdrawal slips. I mean, the whole Project Moondust, for example, is been, there's declassified documents on from Moondust from the State Department, and several of the crashes in Magic Eyes Only discuss or have their source documents in part from FOIA documents that are referencing Moondust. And Moondust, for the most part, was about picking up Soviet junk or other space junk. But many other times, those Moondust teams were called in, and it wasn't space junk from the Soviets or others. It was trashed ET hardware. And so they carted it off to, you know, Wright Patterson Air Force Base or to other locations where they it went to a different compartment. So, I mean, Moondust is an example. The other thing is that, you know, everybody was talking about, well, I have a top secret SCI clearance in Congress. Well, that doesn't get you a Q clearance. That's with the Department of Energy. The Q clearance is where the atomic energy intelligence files are. You know, if you want to read what the power plant is in the Roswell crash or other crashes, that's all in the atomic energy intelligence files in the late 40s and beyond. And it's all top secret Q clearance SCI access. And so they think they know, but they really don't know. And I don't know whether or not Grush knows that, or whether or not the Inspector General knows that, or let alone the M clearance. In one of the FBI files for Lloyd Berkner, one of the MJ-12 members, there was an executive authorization for money, and it basically said Lloyd Berkner is assigned to the Special Studies Project in the White House, M, in parentheses. And I saw that in another FBI file too. So at least in, you know, 47, 48, there was this Special Studies M in the White House, which, given the people, I think certainly stands for Majestic or Magic or something like that. I don't know if they continued with that, but, you know, there's a bunch of doors and clearances that they're just getting exposed to, and they don't understand yet where the evidence really is.
Well, I know one of the most fascinating Majestic documents that I saw was the Special Operations Manual. And I know that there was a lot of work put into authenticating that document. And there was a lot of kind of like zingers, as you have pointed out, that corroborate that that document is real. So, I mean, you know, given that UFO crash retrievals are suddenly a hot topic and people are interested in, well, you know, which corporation has them, you know, how, you know, what kind of reverse engineering projects are happening. Just how important is this Special Operations Manual? And you've included it in Magic Eyes Only. So, yeah just tell us.
Well, this is the most impressive, the most authentic, the highest probability of being totally true is this document, this Special Operations Manual. And it was leaked as Tri-X film in 1994 to Don Berliner. an aviation week and space writer in Washington, D.C. And my father got involved, and they developed all the photographs and negatives, and began, you know, retyping it all into a document. And I'll talk about the document content importances, but I did the FBI thing, so to speak. I said, well, where did it come from? And it came from, it was mailed from La Crosse, Wisconsin. And it was mailed, postmarked at the Quillen Pharmacy. At the same time that the Oshkosh air show was occurring. So it most likely came from somebody who was at the Oshkosh show, who could have flown in from anywhere in the country and mailed it there. But also on the inside of the document was a stamp that said, Unit KB-88, Kirkland Air Force Base, MEX, which was the abbreviation for New Mexico back then in the 50s. You know, if it said NM, we could say, oh, this is a fake. But no, it had the correct abbreviation. And then on the change control page, which is the page that the officers sign their initials to and say, I removed this page and replaced it with this page, and what the date and time was, or the date that they did that. There was two sets of initials, EWL and JRT. And so I went to the Albuquerque phone book in that time frame and scoured through that, and sure enough, found the two guys, both on Perimeter Road, on base, a few houses down from each other at Kirkland Air Force Base. And one was dead, both were dead, actually, but I had some private investigators interview one of the wife, I think. And so that was very compelling and interesting that, hey, oh, well, we, you know, that's the subtlety where we actually know the people and their military records and so forth. So that was the sort of best I could do with the provenance aspect of where this came from. But, you know, when you look at the manual, it's pretty clear as to, you know, what you're supposed to do with a lot of the various hardware. You know, if you have a fragments or machines that are possible propulsion or fuel units and devices, you send it to Area 51 S4. Or if it's a non-mechanical, non-electronic supporting in nature, such as clothing, personal belongings, or organic ingestibles, that's interesting, send it to the Wright-Patterson Blue Lab, which we know has been acknowledged by Barry Goldwater and another general as being authentic. And then there's the weirdness associated with screwdriver being used as two words, which is correct for the time frame and era rather than one word, or the typeset. It was printed on a hot lead printing press, and so the Z's were raised off the line because dust and so forth got in the Z's, which weren't used very often. So it was clearly printed on a hot lead printing press and leaked in 1994, long before software that could do anything like this. So there's...
Well, I was just going to raise one more majestic document that was recently leaked. I think it was 2017 by Heather Wade. This was an alleged briefing document that was originally compiled back in 1989. That's by the Defense Intelligence Agency. So I know your father, Dr. Wood, did a lot of research to authenticate it, so he thinks it's authentic. So where does that stand as far as the Majestic documents are concerned and your own kind of work?
Well, I've read it. I think it's supportive of the Aztec crash. I haven't done much investigation on it. I've just let my dad do that. Because when did it leak out? Like 5 years ago or something?
I think it was 2017 by Heather Wade.
Yeah. So I've just relied on my dad's opinion that, this is good. But I personally haven't studied it. I don't have any real detailed comments about it other than, looks good to me.
Okay. So just to finish up then, you've written, authored these two books, Magic Eyes Only and The AI Ufologist in the last few months. And I know you've got a website, the majesticdocuments.com, where people can go to see all these documents. So what's next for you?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, one of the other things that I did was my dad, had done the Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers by Vernon Bowen many years ago. We both did some of it, and it had been out of print for 5 years. So I quickly made it up on Amazon again. And it's an interesting book in that this was original material, some 200 or 300 pages, 323 pages or so of original documents. But the Air Force chapter and the title page were stamped top secret magic, no foreign dissemination. And that's up on Amazon too, the Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers. And it's interesting in that we did a lot of forensic analysis of that document. There was handwritten notes by Vannevar Bush and commentaries for people that follow ufology will go, interesting. Ink marks and pen marks, but the book itself was very well written. Vernon Bowen was a writer of kids' books, but he wrote this and sent it into the Air Force, and it took 40 years for the Air Force to return it, but it was leaked out. It was returned to Tim Cooper in 1999, I think, after it was being submitted in 1960 or 1959. And it's a lot of great cases that are well documented, water cases, and it's more encyclopedic. It's kind of a lot of cases like Magic Eyes Only. That's focused on crash retrievals. This is more about interesting sightings that he had solid references to. He went to the New York Public Library for lunch because he was a copywriter for several magazines and newspapers, I think. So that was good. And another one that I'm toying with is something called UFOs Who Knows, and this is a collection of famous quotations from people along with their bios. I don't know when that's going to get done, but between a real full-time job and my hobby of ufology and children in life, the plate is full. But it's important to get this done, particularly because you know, I was 20 years ahead of, well, not quite, but 18 years ahead of Grush's disclosure with all these crash retrieval symposium from 2002 to 2008, 2009. And a lot of speakers, including yourself and Rich Dolan and Linda Moulton Howe and Michael Schrat and all the people you see on Ancient Aliens. And I feel proud that at that moment in my life, I could launch a cadre of interested people further along in their explorations into ufology and now coming back to it.
Well, I know you're definitely one of the leading experts on the whole UFO crash retrieval phenomenon, and you know, the books and the conferences you organized, kind of testimony to that. So I hope the Congressman Burchett and others in that oversight committee get you to come in and talk a little bit about some of these historic cases. So people can go to magiceyesonly.com to order the books or go to Amazon. Any final words you want to share with the audience?
Well, I mean, if people are interested in understanding more about the Special Operations Manual, for example, they can go to specialoperationsmanual.com. That's something they can learn about, because that's the most important and most authenticated Majestic 12 document. And I want to express my thanks to you and your continued efforts and diligence in this very complex field, and bringing in all the people that you can to improve the transparency of the phenomenon for everybody. Because I think in the end, it's going to be to the benefit of the world to have a more transparent and open understanding of the phenomenon and our place in it.
Well, thank you, Ryan, for being on Exopolitics today.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.